Thank you for cutting short your coffee. And I want to continue so that David can have all of his allotted time. I'm happy that David Pattenmore's come here from way across the other ocean to give the second part of a talk that he gave, a pre-war Sir Thomas Beecham talk in Chapel Hill 2 years ago. And I welcome you to Santa Barbara. Thanks.
Well, good morning, everybody. I'd like to thank ASK and Mr. Brailovsky and the program committee for this opportunity to share with you my research on Beecham's post-war recording career. And I hope you will find it as interesting as I have found it intriguing. Is that better? Right. I've left copies of the slides, which I'm going to show, on your seats. And I also have copies of the paper on which the talk is based, which is in draft if anybody would like more detail. So the purpose of the talk is quite simple. It's to analyze Beecham's negotiations with the record industry after he left England in 1941. To take up residence in the USA, up to his final recording sessions in 1959. And in each case, there is a period of decay. There are causes, each contract period declined. So I'm trying to identify what the causes of this decay were, and through doing this, to gain a better understanding both of Beecham's priorities and his interaction with the record industry. Because the material is so much more prolific for the final years with EMI, and therefore it's possible to have a much more fine-grained analysis, there will be a concentration in the presentation on the EMI years, which date really from late 55 onwards. The origins of the talk are PhD and postdoctoral research, which I've done at the University of Sheffield, and my sources are, as I've said, the EMI archives, some material made available to me by John Lucas, who is writing a very fine biography of Beecham, which should appear at the end of this year in England, and Michael Gray's discography, as well as interviews with one or two of the key players who worked with Beecham in this period. Sorry, I've got a bit ahead of myself here. Okay, we've basically got three contract periods. The first one, 42 through 49, is when Beecham was contracted to RCA Victor, and his records were released in the UK through its affiliate EMI, and particularly the HMV Mark. The second period is 49 through 55, when he was contracted to Columbia Records Incorporated, and its UK affiliates through till 52 was Columbia, the Columbia mark of EMI, and then after that, Philips Electrical of Holland. And the third contract period from late 55 through 59 was with EMI, and its US subsidiaries at this time were Angel, which lasted through till 58, and then Capitol became the main distributing body for EMI in the USA. A key player in the whole of this period is David Bicknell. He had been at EMI since 1927 when he'd started work as Fred Geisberg's assistant. And he'd worked with Beecham since 1937. And he was in charge of A&R at EMI from 1944 through till 1972. And to give you an idea of this gentleman, for the first extract, I'm going to play a little excerpt from a talk which he gave at the British Institute of Recorded Sound on the 18th of May, 1972. And it's the only time in the course of this two-hour talk where he actually expresses a sense of pride and achievement, which may be interesting in the context of the talk. So if we could have the first example.
Just that when I joined the company, the biggest contract we had for symphonic recording was 16 sessions. Sessions is a period of 3 hours, recording time. 16 sessions a year, which with the London Symphony Orchestra, and our total work, I worked out quite recently, up to the beginning of the war, did not exceed 50 sessions a year. Columbia were doing rather less. Well, the 1950s, the volume of symphonic work recorded in London rose to over 700 sessions, and EMI's share of that was over 500. And that great volume of work enabled two of the finest orchestras in this country to be founded and maintained, first the Philharmonia under Carrion, and almost immediately afterwards the Royal Philharmonic under Sir Thomas Beecham. And I'm very proud that I was head of the Arts Department and all that went on. But the whole thing really was laid on the foundations that were laid so well by Fred Geisberg in his 40 years' work in this country. I think that.
So what happened at RCA? There were four categories of recordings. First of all, recordings contracted by RCA and EMI jointly, which they paid for together. Then there were recordings which either RCA or EMI paid for individually, repertoire which the other company didn't want. Thirdly, there were large-scale projects like The Messiah and Faust, recorded in 47. And fourthly, there were Delius Trust recordings. Now, with this mix of work, the shape of his recordings, you can see there's a graph. He starts slowly in 44. By 47, he's recording, these are approved sides, 78 sides. He's up to 193, and then it gradually tails off. In 47, EMI had 31 discs in reserve, or about 18 months' supply to sell. But as a result of that activity in 47, by 48, they had 96 and a half discs in reserve, which was at least 4.5 years' supply. So Brenchley Mattel, who was the head of EMI Classical Recording, to whom Bicknell reported, wrote to Beecham, said, "We just cannot go on recording at this level." So Beecham had to find another record company in order to fund the Royal Philharmonic Orchestra. Its finances were predicated very much on recording contracts. But in general, this was a very harmonious relationship, and it's the one which produced an enormous amount of extremely fine recordings. So next he contracted with Columbia Records. Now, this worked extremely well up until the switch from EMI to Philips in 1952. And Philips, unlike EMI, had several major disadvantages. First of all, they had no studio. EMI had Abbey Road, but Philips recorded neither Waltham Stowe Town Hall or Hoxton Parish Church, which were a long way from St. John's Wood, where Sir Thomas lived. And this was very inconvenient for him. Secondly, it had no listening facilities or people with whom Beecham could actually discuss his recordings. This meant that there were problems with approval, which in turn affected income. Thirdly, Philips' recording equipment was based for most of the year in Vienna, where they had a contract with the Wiener Symphonica. And so it was only possible for it to record at specific time blocks in the UK. And Michael's discography is very clear on this. It's exemplary, really. The problem for the RPO about this was that it couldn't use recordings to infill the orchestral diary. So, you know, they might have a concert in London and then another one two or three days later in Sheffield, and they could use the day or two in between, they could go into the studio and do a little bit of recording. This was impossible with the Philips contract. So they were losing recording income hand over fist. And also they weren't doing work with other conductors. And so by 1955, Philips did not need any more recordings. They had, they had 13 LPs in reserve, and on top of that, they were able to lease the 5052 product, which had been recorded earlier. So they had 2 to 4 years' supply minimum. And Anthony Griffith, who worked for Philips as an engineer, told me that Philips were actually quoted as saying they were glad to see the back of Beecham when he went to EMI. Now, there was a critical meeting held at the Rice Hotel, Houston, on the 25th of March in 1955. Beecham was conducting in Houston, and Bicknell had been on his tail even before he started a recording for Philips. In June 53, he'd opened discussions with Beecham to return to EMI, even though the first Philips sessions didn't in fact take place till December 53. And in this meeting, Beecham wrote a long list of the repertoire that he wanted to record in what he called his remaining years. And this is the first mention in his plans of what you might call an artistic legacy. Bicknell went on to highlight how wonderful EMI was. It had Abbey Road, it had good listening facilities, all of which were absolutely true. And he also offered the Royal Philharmonic Orchestra in its own right 75 sessions a year annually, only 50 of which were to be with Beecham. And this was requested by Norman Miller, who was the manager of the orchestra at the time. In addition, Bicknell agreed to joint recordings with RCA. And so at this point in time, it looked very good. The deal looked very good from both EMI and Beecham's points of view. I'd just like to give you an example of the list that Beecham proposed. What happened here was that I was going through the files and I came across this handwritten list with the Rice Hotel Houston heading on it from Bicknell, and it just had this long list of works. And then after that, there was a memo of the meeting by Bicknell, which said, Thomas said this was the repertoire he'd like to record. And it's absolutely colossal. First of all, there's all these operas. The numbers, by the way, are the ranking in the list, and these are the works which actually got recorded. None of the others ever got recorded. Then there are major choral works, and then there are the Beethoven symphonies. Now, when I was actually transposing for this for the slide, I think what actually happened was that Beecham just went through the major composers, for instance, with the choral works, and said, well, what is the major work in this genre that they wrote? So you get the Mozart Mass in C minor, the Beethoven Missa Solemnis, Schubert E-flat Mass, Berlioz Requiem, and so forth. But it's important, I think, to bear this in mind as we go along, for reasons which I hope will become apparent to you. So how did he get on with EMI? Well, he got off to a good start. He started recording at the end of 55 and well into 56. And there's a funny story about when Bicknell and Miller saw Beecham off for his American tour at the beginning of 55. Bicknell said to Miller, do you think he'll actually sign this contract? And Miller said, yes, he's just told me he will, because he's bought a new house in the New Forest, which he needs the money for. So, you know, major strategy is put at risk by these minor considerations. There were three repertoire strands, major orchestral works, some of the Rice Hotel works, Haydn and Handel, and also La Bohème in New York. This was produced by Richard Moore with Metropolitan Opera forces and is arguably one of the best Beecham recordings, simply because he had the best people all around him. Andrew Schulhoff, Beecham's agent in the States, suggested to EMI that as things had gone so well, they might like to make him a present for his birthday. So they gave him a check for £1,000. That's equivalent to an annual income for a worker in Britain in this year. So it was quite a large check. But Beecham was obviously very pleased with this, and he wrote to them. He starts this letter by saying, I've had some terrible birthday presents. And then he says, it's easy, therefore, to imagine my glad surprise on being handed the handsome token of your firm's goodwill towards me. Here at last, said I to myself, is something I can really make use of and which strikes a new note in the history of this kind of presentation. If this beneficent action of EMI constitutes a novel departure, then long may the practice continue. I should be obliged if you would accept for yourself and for your colleagues my appreciation of this genuinely friendly gesture, as well as the gift of really 100% smokable cigars. So that's he obviously was very, very pleased with that. However, in 56, things started to happen, which was to erode the happiness in this relationship. First of all, Victor Olof arrived from Decca, where he'd been the chief producer. And he imported into the EMI setup the idea of the producer actually making management decisions, as opposed to being just the recording supervisor who, to quote Denham Ford, Beecham's secretary, just made sure that the music was on the stands at the record sessions. This strange situation had come about because at Decca, Maurice Rosengarten, who was nominally in charge of classical recording, was really only interested in signing artists and negotiating their payments. So he'd left repertoire decisions to the producers. So Olof came in with a totally new perspective on the relationship with the artist, which previous producers like Lawrence Collingwood had not shared at all. Secondly, he was very commercially driven about repertoire. And thirdly, he sought his artistic involvement in listening and the selection of takes. He was far less likely to accede to Beecham's requests. And Beecham frequently complained later of people suggesting to him what takes to use when he was had his own thoughts on the matter. Now, the converse of this was that the old guard, EMI, were leaving. Mattel, who'd made the gift of the cheque of £1,000, he left in 56, and Collingwood's last recording with Beecham was Il Seraglio in early 56. It's interesting to know that Collingwood himself was a very fine conductor. He'd conducted at the Mariinsky Theatre in St. Petersburg and was highly respected by Beecham, whereas Olof had nothing like that at all. Then there were a set of personal circumstances. First of all, Lady Beecham's health was in severe decline at this point. She had become addicted to barbiturates, and Beecham needed money badly for her treatment. So as a result, he pressed EMI for royalty payments and large-scale projects, the opportunity to record large-scale projects, like he'd had the opportunity with RCA for The Messiah and Faust. But there were some problems here. First of all, the initial repertoire, which he'd recorded so successfully in 55, 56, wasn't selling very well. This was things like the Balakirev First Symphony. Very fine recordings, but not meat and potatoes commercially. Secondly, the LP took much longer to bring to market, about 6 months, whereas he wanted the money up front as quickly as possible. And so all these factors were combining to make the royalty income take much longer to arrive. So early 57, he decided to go and live in France to avoid tax. And in fact, this made communications, and especially listening and approval decisions, even more difficult, which, as you can imagine, made it worse when he was working with people whom he didn't really respect. And then there is a third set of factors. As I'm sure many of you will be aware, EMI was not up to speed technically as well as its competition. And in 58, it only had one set of stereo recording equipment for its international program, whereas Decca, the competition, were much further ahead. They were producing much better records. And led by Culshaw, who was Olof's successor, they had a really crack production team. Now, some recordings were made twice, first in mono and then in stereo, which Capitol, which, as I mentioned, came in on the scene from 58, wanted for the US market. The result of this was that the cost of recording doubled and the process blocked different repertoire choices. And this caused immense frustration. Beecham wanted to satisfy the Capitol requirements because he saw the USA as the major market. But EMI didn't want to because they just felt they were throwing good money after bad in duplicating repertoire which wasn't going to sell. An example of this is the Lalo Symphony, which was recorded in the final sessions in 59. But Beecham really was keen to crack the American market for its size and also, obviously, its royalty potential. Now, matters came to a head in June 58 with the recording of Carmen. This seems to have been really a disaster. Only half the opera was recorded. The cast was unprepared. It was recorded on location in the Salle Wagram, which also doubled as a circus and for wrestling. And there was a very poor relationship with Olof. At the end, Bicknell surveyed the situation and took opinions, and Olof said that they should cease using Beecham if they could get out of the contract. And he also, later Olof wrote an article on how they recorded Carmen, and he made the point that they had two recording outfits there, one for mono, one for stereo, and the Beecham insisted that all the cast were there all the time, which was what the singers weren't used to, so there was a massive amount of friction. Then Beecham wasn't able to hear playback satisfactorily. Olof only gave him what he Olof, thought Beecham had approved, whereas Beecham liked to listen to everything. And then to make matters worse, 34 reels of tapes were impounded by customs on the way from France to the UK in the winter of 58-59. So, and in fact, Edward Fowler, who was the chief engineer at EMI, said, "Why are we treating this valuable recording like wood shavings?" in a memo to Bicknell. So clearly there was some crisis. However, the work was finally completed 15 months later in September 59. Now, I'd like to just switch slightly to the issues of style and interpretation. There's lots of correspondence in the files about why things went wrong with Carmen. And one of these is a letter from the conductor Dennis Vaughan, who was Beecham's assistant and the repetiteur on Carmen. And he said that Beecham, whatever we think of him, has priceless knowledge about operatic style. The problem is that some people will not be aware of this. And he suggested that EMI should make a tape of Beecham running through the opera, which should be given to the recording crew and to the coaches so that they had a clear idea of his interpretation. And he pointed out that this had already been done for the film of the Tales of Hoffmann, which had been made by Michael Powell. And what had happened there was Beecham had sat down at Shepperton Studios with a piano and just played through the opera. Now, through the good offices of John Lucas, we actually have this tape. So I'm just going to play you a small example of it. I should warn you that when I played this at a run-through in Sheffield last week, I managed to reduce the academic staff at the management school and the music school to complete hysterics, and they told me afterwards that this was no way a real guide. But personally, I'm a bit of a believer in this, and I take Vaughan's advice. So you can judge for yourselves whether or not you think this might be a suitable guide in the circumstances I've outlined. So if we could have the second example, please.
The healing of the change to the dream. Not my dear. This is the complete change. I recall her in my dreaming, lovelier as the day. I followed in her footsteps with love in my heart. I left my home and kindred and woodland and prey and the valleys in
opinions are very divided on this. So basically, we have two factors in play. First of all, age and mortality are driving Beecham's idea of creating a legacy through his recordings, but he's also using this idea to acquire work to maintain his orchestra, which, remember, had no subvention at all. It was entirely funded by earned income, and that explains the Rice Hotel list. However, Carmen was the actual experience. And it was only Bicknell who saved the day and managed to get the recording back on the rails. At one point, they were proposing to just have highlights from Carmen, the choral works, choral bits, and the orchestral bits without any solos. And Beecham wrote to Bicknell and said, "Don't let foolish pessimist distract you." And it's unclear who he's actually referring to, whether it's himself or other people. I'd like to just quote Bicknell on Beecham at this point, because he was beginning to get unstable, I think, slightly unstable. And he wrote in a letter to F.M. Scott of Capitol Records in the 14th of October, 59, "The fact is that he is a very great conductor and a very old man, and I don't think he gives us any more trouble than Toscanini or Koussevitzky gave RCA. I'm quite sure that he gives no more trouble than Furtwängler gave me to the moment he died. I wish we could sell more of his records, but I don't think we can blame Sir Thomas if we do not succeed, because his standard is invariably tops." So at this point, Beecham started to look around for another company. Early in 59, he asked Capitol if they would take over the management of his contract, but they declined. Then Bicknell refused to record the Berlioz Requiem, even though it had been on the Rice Hotel list, citing budget limits. And by the middle of 58, Beecham was instructing his lawyers to prevent the publication of his recording of his Handel arrangements, Love in Bath, or as orchestral musicians used to call it, Love in the Bath. The final sessions for EMI took place in December 59. And at this point, the International Recording Repertoire Committee had refused to sanction the recording of the Lalo Symphony for the stereo half, but he insisted on recording this with the Franck, and so he was actually saying, I'm going to do what I want. I have no interest in what the company wishes to do. And after this, he said he wasn't going to record anymore. He said recording is too much trouble. And Olof, in a memo to Bicknell, wrote very eloquently, I think, about this. He's talking about Beecham just after the end of the session. He finally informed me very calmly that he would not record again in France, and in fact he was too busy to make any more records in Europe, as it was all too worrying and not worth the trouble. He most probably will change his mind, although on this occasion he was more serious than I have ever known him. But in any case, it will be many months before we can continue recording with him. I am of the definite opinion that only considerably improved sales and better propaganda will influence him to this end. Now, as you probably know, Beecham was ill while he was doing his USA tour of 59-60, and he died early in 61. But he didn't stop at all. In May 60, according to John Culshaw's memoirs, he actually approached Culshaw, just as he'd approached Geisberg in 31, with the proposal to record operas, as there were things which he still wished to record. So you've got the same psychology as the Rice Hotel psychology going on all the way through. However, in this case, he was seen off by Rosengarten, who was very close to Ansommet, and Ansommet regarded the French operatic repertoire, which Beecham had his eyes on, as very much his property. Now, I'd like to show a little bit of a video now, just to give you a sense of what Beecham was like at this time. On the 30th of October, he gave a concert at Lincoln's Inn Fields, and Granada TV made a programme about this, and I'm going to... If I can get the video to work, we'll see a little bit of the rehearsal and then a little bit of the interview which he gave with Peter Brook in the afternoon of this concert.
What year?
1958. Right.
Sir Thomas Beecham, musician and genius, for 60 years music's champion against sloppiness, snobbery and humbug. The man who shouted shut up at the white ties and tiaras at Covent Garden. The man who faced a solid Birmingham audience and cried, let us pray, and got away with it. Now, nearly 80, he's home again. Jaunty and defiant as ever, a character, an institution, and the greatest conductor in the world. Today, he visits Lincoln's Inn. This morning at Lincoln's Inn, some rather unusual things were happening. The judges and barristers, who normally lunch at the long tables, were turned out by 70 musicians of the Royal Philharmonic Orchestra. The lawyers had invited Sir Thomas to conduct before the law's top people at a grand concert tonight in Lincoln's Inn. The rehearsal was called for 10 o'clock this morning. At 3 minutes past 10 precisely, Sir Thomas made his characteristic and unhurried approach to the podium, a vantage point from which for 60 years he has terrified, delighted, and inspired thousands of different players.
What the devil's that? What? Very good.
I thought it was an automatic baton. Relieve me of any responsibility and duty. I trust you realize, gentlemen, after saying good morning, it's an solemn, important, and impressive occasion. I've spent half a sleepless night looking forward to it. Mingled emotions of curiosity, delight, and horror. Now, what do we play? Of course it's too high. What do you think I am? Samson?
Sometimes.
House ballet music. Bum, bum, bum. What are the bars? Used to be anyway.
His wife had died 3 months earlier, and it's amazing how he kept going.
It sounds a bit like Boris Karloff.
It was the English accent. So this is, he has this interview with Peter Brook. I'll just get into it, and you'll see what he was like.
It's immense. The face of the eyes are everything. But more than that, there is a link between an intelligent player and a first-class orchestra, which, after all, this orchestra is. Now then, these people notice my expression. Yeah. And also, there's the link between us, by which what I'm thinking, with fierce concentration, everything to me, that's communicated to them, and they know.
Don't those men get more easily bored and weighed down by the routine performances that they're giving
five times
a week?
Well, I know, but that's inevitable. There are only three or four of us in the world who know how to conduct, really, anyway. And only three or four of us left. Never were more than a dozen of army days. Now, good God, every year someone disappears. Both Wagner, Foscadini, somebody else, Strauss, they're all going. Besides, I'd be left like Robinson Crusoe on a desert island without even the man Friday conducting. It's in a hopeless position. It's a dying occupation.
Why do you think that is?
Where are they?
Why aren't they?
Well, they haven't got the brains or the musical concentration or any heart or soul. Significance in them. They don't feel the music. They're not born with it. They're not born with that absolutely burning devotion to music. They think casually, like gentlemen. Bah!
So I think that's quite revealing. So just looking at the EMI contract, what were the causes of the decay here? There are basically four key factors. In the note where Bicknell turns down the Berlioz Requiem proposals, he lets slip the fact that they have a budget of £22,000 for 11 discs a year for Beecham's recording. So there was no way they could have recorded the Berlioz Requiem because he budgeted that at just over £13,000. So it couldn't deliver on his Rice Hotel promises, especially without a US partner like RCA funding it. So that was one problem. He was frustrated in terms of repertoire. Secondly, he disliked producer interference in recording and approval decisions. As I said, he believed they were interested in what they thought was best rather than what he thought was best. Thirdly, he got extremely frustrated with slow royalty payments. And fourthly, the newer technologies were making listening and approval much more difficult for him, and therefore royalty payments slower. Beecham was used to, particularly in the 78 days, he was used to approving 78 shellac masters, which were sent to his home. And Denham Ford mentions that he had mock tests all over the place, and he would listen to them three or four times, each one, before he'd make a final decision. Tape made this much more difficult. He didn't actually have a tape machine, so they had to be listened to either in studios or specific places. And it was also much more difficult to manipulate. And in fact, in Carmen, what happened was with Carmen, Olof eventually arranged for all the takes to be put on acetates for Beecham to hear with Eric MacLeod, who, and then to decide which bits to keep and which not. So the advance of technology actually was difficult for him in terms of getting to a decision, but he needed the decisions to get to the money. So drawing to a conclusion, let's look at the overview. Basically, the contracts were merely the legitimation for a start of what was essentially a social process. And if Beecham didn't have a respect from the staff, then the process appears to have been pretty doomed, really. And he certainly didn't get that with Phillips, nor after Olof arrived with EMI. In 49 and 55, he had to change companies to main income to finance the RPO. And then with EMI, you get this new factor, the idea of a legacy, as well as recordings as a source of income. But the basic result was that legacy creation had to yield to commercial pressures. It was simply too expensive. And in the final analysis, Beecham was always chasing money to fulfill his dreams. And in the process, he created a different legacy from that which he intended, but one I think that still lives on. So just to finish, I'd just like to play an extract from the climax of the César Franck Symphony, which was one of the final works he recorded in December 59. So we could have that, please. I'm not aware of that, but I'm not really the person to ask. I can see some, maybe other people have more knowledge. Can anyone help on this one?
Yes. While I was producing reissues for Sony Classical, I made extensive inquiries and research into the surviving Beecham material. Michael Gray, my colleague, can confirm much of this. The fact of the matter is that Columbia Records in New York, for whom these recordings were made, first by EMI and then by Phillips, did not retain, once Phillips came into the picture, any master material whatsoever. Whatever came into New York was copied, and the originals apparently were returned. This seems to be the MO at that time. Whether for customs reasons or what, I'm not absolutely sure. But in any event, nothing but mono submasters were retained by Columbia. Those masters were then copied and for distribution to other local affiliates after 1965 when Phillips and Columbia split. Obviously, whatever masters had been made by Phillips and then by EMI later were not in New York. So where were they was my next step. I made repeated inquiries to Phillips and got undeniable, it's not my problem, pardon. As far as I know, there was a certain quantity of material by Beecham and by other Columbia artists who made records in Europe that Phillips did. Some of it probably left the archive in Barn as the form of trophies. God knows this has happened often enough in the case of the Columbia and the RCA tape vaults. In any event, no master generation has been found for any of the recordings made past 1950. There are a few master tapes, the B set of master tapes, was shipped to New York when the Beecham recordings with the RPO were being made by EMI on behalf of American Columbia. So the Berlioz Te Deum and virtually all the other Delius recordings, for instance, survive only in very deteriorated XLP, which is the LP production tape that are filed with the Sony Music Archive tapes in upstate New York. We did discover a second copy of A Massive Life, which was a submaster in the hands of someone who had been associated with the Beecham estate. And this was discovered 7 years ago when I was in London. And the owner of it agreed to make it available for transfer digital so that we could issue something of better source than what was available, because the tape that exists in the Sony Music Archives has gross azimuth error on it and makes it fundamentally unusable for any further reissue. Of course, that won't stop anyone from using it, but it points up a real problem with the surviving Beecham tape documents.
Sorry, Michael.
I've actually been in Barn twice, the last time in after RSK in London. There is no Beecham material there, although they do have the session booking forms which show the crew going from Vienna to London. Secondly, there was a costing made for a proposed Beecham recording of the Magic Flute in the spring of 1960. That apparently, of course, never happened, but certainly they were planning to do it. The costing was made, but EMI and Beecham never agreed to do it, and I believe he became too ill to actually fulfill that obligation. If you want to talk to me later, I'm right here.
Seth.
I just want to add one quick thing Dennis forgot to mention. Dennis will bear me out on this. In 42, when Beecham made the recording for the New York Philly, he heard the test back, and they were so dreadful, he put an injunction against Columbia to issue those, and they became rather scarce. Then, what was it, in 49, he came back, Dennis, for the Columbia Symphony, and, of course, we had access to the recording on the sheet, and there's Beecham's signature across it saying, I give approval to all this Sir Thomas Beecham, because they didn't trust him that he would sue again.
He didn't trust them.
Right. No, before he walked out on that session, whatever was approved, he wrote, I approve everything Sir Thomas Beecham and dated it. So this way, he couldn't go and do anything about it.
There's a very interesting letter which came to me through John Lucas, and I suspect to other sources, which is the letter to Goddard Lieberson rejecting the 42 recordings. And his reasons for this are principally, and I say this with the greatest respect to American musicians, that the players that he used, he felt didn't have enough individuality. Now that may have been his responsibility as a conductor.
Also the fact that it was a New York Philharmonic that wasn't the standard one.
Yes.
It was recorded almost at the beginning of the summer of 42. He was also having problems. We heard on the disc when we played it back, actually, the fans coming on.
Right.
That was the key. What did they do with that? Was it Liederkranz?
The recordings were made at Liederkranz Hall, which Columbia had used since the mid-30s as a broadcasting venue and continued to use when Columbia took over the that is, CBS took over the Columbia Records label. Liederkranz was used in 1940, 41, and 42, up to the beginning of the so-called Petrillo Band, and Beecham's recordings with the New York Philharmonic were what was purported to be the New York Philharmonic, and was, in fact, only a rump orchestra without the principal players, were made just weeks before the band was imposed. And not only were, in the Mendelssohn Italian Symphony, for instance, the blowers, the ventilation blowers in Liederkranz were left on inexplicably. And you can hear them, in addition to which they were experimenting with adding reverb in the master lacquers themselves. So that they were doing this, trying to mitigate the unfavorable And eventually, of course, they admitted defeat in Leader Franz by moving into Carnegie Hall as soon as the control of Van was lifted and staying there until they moved to the 30th Street Studios in the end of 1948. But it was not the actual New York Philharmonic that made the recording. That certainly was one of his principles.
I'm very grateful indeed for that information, because I didn't know that. And that obviously explains the situation. Thank you.
I want to say thank you, too. I don't want to cut into the next speaker's time because I'm the next speaker.
Oh, right.